to continue on with addressing some of the many questions that were presented about church finance. Today I want to focus in on, we've talked previously about benevolence, the church's role in benevolent action. Today I'm going to talk about probably the most uncomfortable of all the topics, at least for me, and that is questions pertaining to supporting the preacher. There were several questions that were submitted in this vein, and I don't want to just ignore them. I will say this, with the questions that I received and other things that I've heard as I've discussed this topic, you know, on a personal level or in other settings, it is clear to me that not everybody understands how the support of the preacher works. And so that's one of the reasons why I want to spend some time this morning looking at this question of supporting preachers and see if I can not only just answer the questions that have been submitted, but also help us to evaluate how that process of supporting a man to do the work of preaching and teaching is supposed to work from a biblical perspective. And so we're going to put it under the category then of church finances related to the work of evangelism. And I actually want to begin by looking at some precedents that are set even before the church was established in the time of Jesus' ministry. Oftentimes, Jesus would send out his disciples ahead of himself to various cities and villages and towns to preach the gospel in preparation for him coming to visit. You can read about it in Matthew and Mark and Luke. What is interesting is that consistently, whether he's sending out the 12 or sending out the 70, he tells them, I don't want you to take any money with you. When you go, just go to the town and begin to preach, and the people who listen to you preach, if they welcome you into their house, accept the hospitality from them and stay with them as long as they will host you. And so you get this idea then. I do want to look just at this one passage in Luke chapter 10, because I find it interesting. We'll circle back to this statement later on in our discussion. But he's sending out the 70 in pairs to all of the cities. He tells them in Luke chapter 10 in verse 4, he says, carry no money belt, no bag, no shoes, greet no one on the way. Whatever house you enter first, say, peace be with this house. And if a man of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. If not, it will return to you. He says, stay in that house, eating and drinking what they give you, for the laborer is worthy of his wages. Jesus is the one who makes that statement that a laborer is worthy of his wages, and he puts it in the context of somebody going out to preach the gospel and receiving from those whom he teaches support to do so. And so we see here this principle already in the ministry of Jesus and in the work of his disciples that the student, the one who is taught the message, ought to share with the one who teaches. Right, Paul will solidify that idea when he writes to the Galatians years later in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 6, where he explicitly tells them the one who is taught the word is to share all good things with the one who teaches him. Okay? And so we see that principle even in the ministry of Christ. There's also this other interesting thing happening in the ministry of Christ, and it's referred to as these ministering women. Jesus, they're referred to a couple times towards the end of his ministry in Matthew 27 and in Mark chapter 15. They're actually at the cross of Jesus as he's being crucified. And the commentary is that these were women who followed him from Galilee and used to minister to him. You're like, well, what does that mean? Used to minister to him. Well, Luke, in his account, Luke chapter 8, gives us an insight on what that ministering looks like, because the word that's actually used there is really the same. It's the verb form of diakonos, which is the idea of being a servant for somebody. But here in Luke chapter 8, he talks about this same group of women. Notice in verse 1, he says, soon afterwards he began going around from city to city, village, one village to another, proclaiming and preaching the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and sickness, Mary who was called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Chaza, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others who, notice this, were contributing to their support out of their private means. They were contributing, they were having fellowship, koinonia, with Jesus and his disciples by supporting them from their monetary resources to do the work of preaching and teaching the gospel as they traveled throughout the regions of Galilee and Judea. And so they were sharing or ministering to Jesus by sharing their monetary resources to promote, facilitate, and finance Jesus' ministry as an itinerant preacher. And I would suggest to you on these two grounds alone, we can safely conclude that an individual person is well authorized to support a man who is doing the work of preaching and teaching. Nobody can tell any individual that if they want to support somebody to do that work, that they can't do that from a biblical standpoint. There's clear biblical precedent for that idea. Individual Christians can support preachers. But more to our question and our topic is the church authorized to support men to preach the gospel? And I would answer simply, yes, both locally and abroad. And I'll try to substantiate both of those claims. First, turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul is having a discussion with the Corinthian brethren about the exercising of liberties or rights. That is, things that we're authorized to do by God, but which we don't necessarily have to do. Okay? But the thing that he uses to illustrate this point is the support of evangelists, the support of preachers. He establishes in his discussion here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that indeed it is a right, a liberty of a preacher to expect to be supported financially for the work he does at preaching and teaching. That a preacher has the right to, use Paul's words, get their living from the gospel. And again, the idea of getting a living is the same thing you would think of as what you do to make a living, right? It's the work that you do in order to make income so that you can sustain your life and provide for your needs and the needs of your family and those who are dependent upon you. Let's just read real quick, starting in verse 6. Paul says, "Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Who tends the flock and does not use the milk of the flock?" Paul points to some examples here to illustrate his point that if a guy's doing the work of preaching, he ought to be compensated for that. Soldiers don't pay their own way to go out and be a soldier. No, they're paid for that. He says those who tend the vineyard or who work in the vineyard or who tend the flock, they have the benefit of eating from the produce of the fruit of their labor. And he says in verse 8, "I'm not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law also say these things? For it is written in the law of Moses, 'You shall not muzzle an ox while he is threshing.'" That was part of the law. If an ox, even an animal, a beast of burden, is going around and carrying the wheel for the threshing sledge, so to speak, and there's some grain that falls on the ground, and he's going around, he's entitled to be able to eat some of that that's falling on the ground as he's doing his work. Paul says, you know, God wasn't really concerned about oxen, is he? No, he's speaking altogether for our sake. "For our sake," it was written, verse 10, "because the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we reap material things from you?" Paul's saying the work that we're doing, yes, it may be spiritual in nature, but the fruit that we should share from that should be physical in nature or material. And then he uses a precedent that is set by those who served as priests in the temple. He says, "Do you not know that those who perform the sacred service eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share from the altar?" Now, anybody, whether in the pagan world or in the Jewish world, would recognize that the priests who serve in the temple, something that they would consider to be a spiritual function, that when the sacrifices were brought in, that the priest got a portion of that material sacrifice, and that was how he provided food for himself. It was something that was given by those who were coming to worship, but he got a portion of that. So he appeals to example, he appeals to precedent, but then he appeals also to directive. Notice in verse 14, "So also the Lord," and this is a reference, I believe, back to what we just read there in Luke chapter 10, "the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel." A laborer is worthy of his wages. Okay? It's interesting to me that Paul here not only seems to establish that a preacher has the right to expect to be compensated for his work, but that he also has a right to expect enough compensation to take care of not just his personal needs, but also the needs of any family that he has. If you jump back in the text, notice in verse 4, he says, "Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brother of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working?" Now, obviously, Paul was a single guy, but he's pointing to his situation and the situation of some of the other apostles who were married and had families. He's saying nobody seems to have a problem with them being supported to take care of their families for the work they're doing. Why should I be restrained? If I wanted to have a wife, couldn't I have a wife and still be supported for that? The logical answer here is yes, you ought to be. Not only does Paul establish these rights, but here the whole tenor of his argument with the Corinthians is that the preacher has the right to expect that support from the people among whom he labors directly. A right, by the way, that Paul routinely chose not to exercise. He certainly chose not to exercise that while he was at Corinth. He didn't accept support from the Corinthian brethren while he was in Corinth preaching the gospel to the Corinthians. But the whole tenor of his argument is that is what he had a right to do. The reason why Paul chose not to exercise this right was for various reasons. Some were very personal to him, and others were just pragmatic. For example, he was obligated to preach the gospel. Unlike many men who choose to preach the gospel, maybe because they feel like God has given them the skills or the abilities or the talent to do that, and so they feel like, I ought to do that for the Lord. Maybe some guys who don't feel like they have the talent, but they see the need anyway, and so they say, I'm going to do that for the Lord. They do it voluntarily. That wasn't the case with the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul was designated, even before he was born by God, he was his chosen instrument that he would bear the gospel to the Gentiles. And so Paul says here in this section, I really didn't have a choice about it. In verse 15, he says, I've used none of these, that is his rights to expect support. And he's saying, I'm not writing these things so that it will be done in my case, for it would be better for me to die than to have any man make my boast an empty one. Well, what is this boast that Paul is talking about? He says, for if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast about, for I'm under compulsion. For woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. Paul's attitude was, if I don't do what God told me to do, I'm in big trouble with God. And so I'm not getting any kind of reward or benefit in this life from preaching the gospel, because God said, you don't have a choice about it, Paul. You're going to do this. Paul says, but if I do it voluntarily, then I would have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. And that was Paul's situation. So what then is my reward, Paul says? That when I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel without charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. Paul says, for my own personal reasons, so that I can feel a sense of reward in the work that I'm doing, I'm choosing not to be supported by the people who I'm preaching to. And that gives me a sense of satisfaction. I don't know exactly what all it was, but there was something about that. It was his boast that he could say, listen, yes, God told me I have to do this, but this is my way of showing you that I want to still, by not taking support for that. But he did it for other reasons. There was also a lot of itinerant preachers going around and philosophers and people peddling their brand of wisdom in the day of Paul, especially in and around Greece. And oftentimes those guys were like scam artists. They were hustlers. They'd roll into town and they'd say, hey, believe this new thing that I'm teaching you. By the way, give me a little bit of money and it'll really work for you. And people would pay them because they're like, this is new, this is interesting, this is going to transform my life. Paul didn't want to be associated with those kinds of people. And so oftentimes, if he'd come to a place where that was really happening, he would say, no, I'm not taking any money from you, because I'm not like those other people who are peddling their wisdom for monetary gain. He didn't want to make it a hindrance for the gospel. He didn't want somebody to say, oh, the gospel is just like any of those other new religions that are being peddled around. He wanted it to stand out. But thirdly, he did it oftentimes because he wanted to set an example to other Christians who were not preachers that God expects us as his people to work hard to support ourselves. There was a system in the Mediterranean world at this time called the patron-client relationship, where the poor people would swear their allegiance to some rich benefactor or client. They would become their patron. We still use this terminology. We patronize an establishment. We go there and give them stuff and expecting them to give us stuff in return, right? And here in the old system, it was that the poor people, they didn't have a way to pay for their food or pay for their shelter, and so they would swear their allegiance to this benefactor, this client, who then, anytime he ran for a political position or wanted to get something done in the town, it was their responsibility to go and vote for him or to turn out for him. Now, this is problematic for a couple reasons. Number one, it can make people lazy. People who could work won't work because they're getting what they need from their benefactor. But secondly, and more to the point for a Christian, is that it divides your allegiance oftentimes between God and some other person. And so what if your benefactor tells you you're going to do X, Y, and Z when God has said you cannot do that? Well, if I've sworn my allegiance to my benefactor and I'm dependent upon them for my sustenance, I'm going to be at the best tempted to deny God in order to support a human. So Paul said, I don't think that that's a good idea. I don't want any Christians doing that. And so I'm making a point, even though I could be supported to preach, I'm going to work hard with my hands when I'm among you to give you an example that you are supposed to work hard with your hands to provide for yourself. Now, having said all that, that doesn't mean that Paul never received support from any churches or any brethren for the work of preaching. In fact, there is a great case study, I think, for receiving what I'll call outside support from the Apostle Paul. Go with me to the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 18. In Acts chapter 18, Paul arrives at the city of Corinth for the first time. And in verse 2, it says that he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. And when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. Let me paint that in my own words. Paul gets to Corinth, he's all alone. His other traveling companions on his second preaching trip are back up in Macedonia. And he has to find a way to support himself. Well, he had by trade the ability, the knowledge, to be a tent maker, a leather worker, essentially. And he finds a couple Jews who also have that same trade, and so they've got their tools, and he says, can I work with you and alongside you to make some money to support myself and sustain myself while I'm with you? And so what he's doing is he's working throughout the week, to use our terminology, at tent making, and then on the weekends, he's going into the synagogues and he's preaching the gospel, working as an evangelist. But when Silas and Timothy come down from Macedonia, all of a sudden we see a shift. Now Paul's not working during the week as a tent maker. Rather, he's devoting himself solely to the word, solely to preaching the gospel. What was it about Timothy and Silas arriving that now allowed Paul to be able to put off tent making and devote himself solely to preaching? Well, maybe it was that Timothy and Silas were also tent makers, and so they worked doubly hard to take care of all three of them. That's a possibility. But inferences from other passages of Scripture and other writings of Paul would indicate that it was more than that. That Timothy and Silas, when they came down from Macedonia, they brought support from churches in Macedonia down to Paul, so that he could devote himself totally to preaching the gospel there in Corinth. in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul reminds the Corinthians, he says, you guys remember that when I was with you, I didn't take a penny from anybody there. I didn't accept support from any of you for preaching the gospel when I was with you. Rather, he says, I robbed wages from other churches, specifically churches in Macedonia, who when my brethren came down, brought enough to fully supply my need. Along with that, we have the supporting evidence from what Paul says to the Philippians, which, by the way, Philippi is a church in, guess what province? Macedonia, okay? And he says, when he starts writing to them in Philippians chapter 1, he says, you know, in all of my prayers, verse 4, always offering prayer with joy, my every prayer for you all, in view of your participation, koinonia, your fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now. There was some sense in which the Philippian brethren had this fellowship, partnership with the Apostle Paul in the preaching of the gospel from the day that he first arrived there in Philippi till the present day when Paul's writing this letter, which is, by the way, about a span of 10 to 12 years. Well, what is this fellowship, this participation? I would suggest to you it's the same thing we read about of those ministering women who participated or contributed to the needs of Jesus. In fact, I know this for certainty because if you turn over to Philippians chapter 4 and verse 15, Paul references this financial aspect of their sharing in the gospel with them. He says in verse 15, you yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. And even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. Well, what is this gift? Not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek the profit which increases on your account. And I have received everything in full and have an abundance. I'm amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, a fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. This gift that he's talking about receiving is financial means to do the work of preaching. In fact, I would argue that the wages that he stole from other churches in Macedonia, at least in part, consisted of wages that came from the church in Philippi for him to preach the gospel there in Corinth. And so let me suggest to you that from these examples here, we could conclude a couple things. Number one, a local preacher oftentimes has to supplement the local support. And he can do that in a couple of ways. He could get a secular job, working with his hands, tent making, bus driving, to supplement the support that he's getting to do the work of preaching and teaching. Or he could seek and receive wages, support, from other churches in other places who would send that to him to help him to be able to sustain himself and his family so that he can do the work of preaching the gospel in that location. But who decides? Who decides where the preacher gets his support from for the work of preaching that he's doing? He does. Who decides how much the preacher needs to do the work of preaching that he's doing in a specific location? He does. That's the whole tenor of these examples and instruction from Scripture. That it's up to the prerogative of the preacher to determine these things. It's his responsibility to ensure that he has those things lined up. Now, certainly a preacher has a right to expect those among whom he labors to support him in the work that he's doing. And I will tell you, I have somewhat of an expectation of my brethren here that you will help me in that. But a preacher can also go outside of the local group and seek support from outside sources as well, whether that be other congregations. And if you'll look at my report, you'll notice that there are a host of other congregations and some individuals who share in my support to do the work here. And additionally, a preacher has a right to get some extra work, some secular work, to supplement that income as well, if that is what he deems necessary. But it's really up to the man who's doing the work to decide, determine, and secure the support to facilitate the work that he's doing. To the question of how much should he get, I will tell you this. This is tough. This is really difficult for me personally, and I know for a lot of other men who do the work of preaching, especially when they have to get outside support to do the work. It's nice when a congregation says to a preacher, hey, we want you to come work with us, and we're going to support you X amount of dollars to do that work. And the guy looks at it and he says, I can live off of that amount. And they agree. But when you come to a congregation and they say, well, we can't support you at all, or we can only support you this amount, and the guy knows full well that's not enough to live off of and take care of my family, how does he decide how much extra support or additional support to the local support should he seek? And I'll tell you, it's tough. Most preachers I know try to approach that question as reasonably and selflessly as they can, always trying to heed the admonition of the Apostle Paul that he gives in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul says to Timothy, godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and clothing or covering, raiment, some of the translations say, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. I don't want to be guilty of that, guys. But where do you strike that balance with being perceived as wanting more and recognizing that it's a tough pill to ask your wife and kids to swallow if I'm literally going to say, as long as we have food and a place to sleep, that's all we're asking for. Oftentimes, it's been my observation and my personal experience that preachers tend to undersell themselves. We have a real hard time, borrowing the words from a friend of mine, appropriately advocating for ourselves and our families. Because we don't want to be perceived as somebody who's just trying to take advantage of the generosity and the love of our brethren. Oftentimes, many preachers will take on extra work and work extra hours and extra hard just to make ends meet, because we don't want to be a burden on our brethren. When do you need to increase the amount that you're getting in support? This is one of the things that I struggle with the most. This is just pulling the curtain back. You guys can look into my heart and my experience. I've been here for 15 years. I've probably asked for 3 or 4 raises over those 15 years. And usually the only reason why I have is because things have reached critical mass in the budget and I don't have a way to make ends meet. And so I have no other choice. I realize, okay, now it's time. I don't have a choice. I have to ask. And that's always been an uncomfortable thing for me. And a great challenge. And quite frankly, if it weren't for the counsel of a couple, 2 or 3 of my brothers here, to help me with that, I probably wouldn't have had the courage to do it. You know, it's nice when you have a secular job where you go and punch a clock. Because if you have some extra expenses that month, you could just ask for some overtime, can't you, Kenny? That's not a luxury that I have. Or any preacher. Because really, the closest analogy, just to put it in perspective, would be like somebody who's a salaried position. You know what that's like, Todd. Doesn't matter how many hours you work, your salary stays the same. You've agreed, I'll work for this amount of money. Now, a lot of people who are salaried do end up sometimes, you know, getting a bonus or something like that from time to time if the company does well and things. Again, that's not something that is common for preachers. And guys, I'm not saying all of this to have a pity party for myself, but I really do honestly believe that unless you've walked in the shoes of a preacher's family, most of us don't even ever think about these things. And that's because it's not a part of our experience. So I'm not faulting anybody for not thinking about it. But I think if we're going to talk about this subject, these are things that are worth bringing up. But ultimately, it is the preacher's responsibility to make these determinations. And I'm just telling you, for me, it's really, really hard. Especially in the absence of clear guidance and direction and feedback from those who have been there before or those with whom I'm working. And so even though I have suggested that it's the prerogative of the preacher to determine his support situation, how much, where it comes from, etc., that doesn't mean that the church, whether locally or abroad, can't take some initiative in this regard. The congregation, especially if you have a man who's committed to working with you, could, let me suggest, periodically evaluate the work that he's doing and give him some feedback about that. Maybe that comes in the form of what I don't like very much, constructive criticism. Josh, we don't really think that you're using this part of your time wisely. We would rather see you focus more in these areas over here, because that's a greater need for us. I tell you, as much as I don't like the constructive criticism, having that guidance would be something that I would find invaluable. It could come in the form of suggestions of what we need to focus on as a group, what we need to be working on as a group. You know, sometimes it's challenging as a preacher, especially in a congregation that has no elders, to try to find and lay out a sense of direction for the whole group. That's something that we all could be working on together. If I had a clear sense of where we want to get to as a group, that would make it a lot easier for me to try to plot out some steps along the way to get there. But sometimes I feel like I'm trying to plot out steps to a destination that's undefined. It could come in the form of, you know, looking at the work that he's doing and saying, you know what? That's worthy of some reward. Maybe we'll give him a raise. Maybe we'll give him a bonus. I'm not asking for this. I'm just saying this as ways of suggestion. You don't know how helpful it would be to me as a preacher, and sometimes reassuring, to just let me know whether or not you think I'm on the right track. And I'm talking about with my finances or with the preaching that I'm doing or the teaching that I'm doing or the focus of my work. I will not be offended if any of you were to come and ask me, how are you guys doing financially? I know a lot of people don't like it when folks, you know, dabble in their finances or want to know how much they're making or something like that. I'm not going to be offended by that. I would appreciate it. It would be encouraging to me to have people come and ask from time to time, how's the work going? What are we focusing on? Can we brainstorm together? Can I help out with something? Is there an area of the work that you see that I might be suited for, that I could get involved in? Here are some talents that I think that I have. Put me to work. Which, by the way, those are responsibilities of an evangelist as well, is to equip the saints to do the work of service. So, those are just some suggestions. Let me was going to wrap up by some odds and ends. There are a couple other areas where churches might could support somebody who's doing a work among them. Elders, Paul says, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, 17 and 18, are worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. The single honor for an elder would be that we respect him, we submit to him, we trust him, we follow his guidance. The double portion is to be financially supported for that, because there's two principles in that section that Paul references, which are, by the way, the same two principles that he cited in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 as justification for supporting a preacher. A laborer is worthy of his wages, and don't muzzle the ox. Okay? And it's not just for preachers who happen to be serving as elders, by the way. If you have a guy who is an elder and also functioning as a preacher, then especially that guy ought to be worthy of the double honor. But I think contextually, any elder is worthy of that, is what Paul is teaching. And I wonder to myself, maybe that's why Paul says, when he's giving characteristics for a guy to serve as an elder, that he can't be one who is fond of sordid gain. Because if he's being supported to do the work of an elder, to shepherd the flock, he's going to have to be careful. He can't be the kind of guy that money bends or influences the direction in which he leads or what he teaches, right? Then that also got me thinking about the fact that that same characteristic is given for deacons, that they can't be fond of sordid gain either. And so I wonder, if elders shouldn't be fond of sordid gain because they're supported to do the work they're doing, is it possible that deacons can't be fond of sordid gain because they're supported to do the work that they're doing? Or, as another possibility, maybe it's simply that the deacons, as per Acts chapter 6, have direct access to the finances of the church. And so it's very important that those who handle the money can do so in an honorable way. I throw that out there to say, I want us to be thinking about this topic. If I piqued your interest a little bit with some of those last couple points, and you're thinking, oh, I never thought about that before. Good. Because I want us to be thinking about this. I want us to continue to evaluate the subject of church finance, to think about it critically, objectively, and most importantly, biblically, to see if there are any ways that we can bring our practice as a local church more in line with what the Scripture and the biblical pattern lays out for us.